Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, 2015 was a pretty good year for the American masses, economically speaking. Elise Gould will join us to review the latest numbers from the Census Bureau. And then at the bottom of the hour, Joel Bainan will correct all the encomia that have been spoken and published for the Israeli politician Shimon Peres, who died earlier this week. First, income and poverty. Economics often deals with matters at a high level of aggregation, abstraction even, big things like GDP, trade, capital flows, financial markets. But the economy is supposed to exist to serve human needs, even if it usually seems like it's the other way around. For much of the past 40 years, average household incomes have stagnated, and those at the bottom have languished, while aggregations like GDP and asset values grew enormously. And most of the gains of that sort of growth accrued to the top 1 to 2% of the population. So it came as a surprise when the Census Bureau reported a couple of weeks ago that real median household incomes, that is, the income earned by a household at the very middle of the income distribution adjusted for inflation, rose in 2015, and the share of the population living in officially defined poverty fell, and both quite sharply. For the last several business cycles, incomes continued to fall and poverty to rise even after the recessions ended and recoveries were underway. This time around, the recession ended in 2009, but incomes continued to fall for a couple of years afterwards and then went flat. 2015's increase was the first since 2007, just before the onset of the Great Recession. Poverty followed a similar trajectory, only in mirror image, rising with the recession, flat from 2010 to 2014, but not declining until last year. While last year's news was good, real incomes are still below where they were in 2007 and 1999, and the poverty rate higher than it was in those two peak years, and, for that matter, 1977. When the numbers were released, conspiracists right and left poo-pooed them, claiming that the figures were cooked up by the Census Bureau. They weren't. There's plenty of official evidence emerging from the statistical machinery of the U.S. government showing just how bad things can be for many people if you know how to look for it. They just don't make this stuff up, you know. Here's Elise Gould, a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, with more. Elise Gould. So the American working class had a pretty good year of it last year, right? Incomes up, poverty down. Let's just review the landscape here. The income gain was quite sharp, so talk about that sum and what might be behind it.
Sure. We look at median household income. That rose between 2014 and 2015 by 5.2%. It's quite a strong increase. We think about benchmarking that, we are still down 4.6% since 2007, since before the Great Recession hit, and we're still about 5.2% below where we were in 2000. So definitely a good year, and a good year primarily because we saw earnings increase. So these are income, mostly middle-income families are getting their income from earnings, and we saw a pretty big increase in earnings as well.
Now, real wage growth has been running around 2%, so why did the household earnings pop up so much?
Hourly wage growth actually went up pretty substantially as well. So, and the full-time, full-year earnings went up about 1.5% for men and 2.7% for women. We actually also saw hours, like household hours, went up. And so when you put those two things together, that can lead to an increase in median household income of a higher amount.
And in recent years, we've seen elderly households doing better than non-elderly ones. Did that change this year? Or last year, rather?
So when we look just at median non-elderly household income, and it's important to look at them separately because you're looking at mostly working-age households, those that would get most of their income from work as opposed to retirement income or Social Security, they also got a pretty big boost. They got a boost of 4.6% between 2014 and 2015, but they more substantially are behind where they were in 2000. They're still 8.2% below where they were in 2000.
And then what can we say about racial disparities?
The income of median white non-Hispanic household income, so white household income at the median, the middle for typical white families, white households, I should say. That increased 4.4% between 2014 and 2015, and their level remains much higher than that of African-American households and Hispanic households, although both of those also got a decent boost between 2014 and 15, 4.1% for African-American households and 6.1% for Hispanic households.
Well, what about gender gaps for workers?
When we look at median earnings for men versus women full-time, men at the median were making $51,000 compared to just under $41,000 for women. We did see a slight decline in the gender pay gap. So when you consider how many cents on the dollar women make in the data in 2014, that was 79 cents on the dollar at the median. Now it's 80 cents on the dollar at the median. So a slight increase. So women's earnings did grow mildly faster than men's earnings did between 2014 and 2015.
What does that gender gap look like over a longer stretch of time?
We have seen a substantial narrowing of that gap over the last 35 years, particularly at the median. We have seen a substantial narrowing of that gap. And that's great. Unfortunately, according to my research, about 30% of that narrowing of the gap is because men's wages have actually fallen. Typical men's wages have fallen over the last 35 years, while women's wages have increased, albeit slightly, mostly due to the fact that women have increased their educational attainment to an increasing extent compared to men, have also entered occupations that they hadn't been in before. And so there was a closing of that gap for those reasons, but also men's wages have simply been falling.
And why is that?
Well, in general, we have seen wages for most Americans have been falling over the last 35 years, or at least stagnating, and that's because we have seen growing inequality, a disconnect between a growing economy and wage growth for the vast majority. We've become more productive as a society, so our productivity has grown, GDP has grown, and yet those returns have really not gone into people's paychecks to any great extent.
But what happened to inequality in 2015?
That's a great question. So inequality, when we look at family income, there wasn't much of an increase, though it's important to keep in mind that we still have seen growing inequality. If we look at from 2007, 2015, the only group that has regained the income that they had in 2007 to any extent has been the top 5%. So pretty much everybody else is still worse off than they were back in 2007. So before the Great Recession hit, people are still trying to make up that lost ground.
What's happening at the low end? We've seen, you know, a long period of time in which the bottom 20 or 30% of the income distribution has done very badly. How did they do in 2015?
We did see a drop in the poverty rate, so it's great news. We saw median incomes rise, we saw earnings rise, and at the very bottom, we did see this drop in the poverty rate. So it fell 1.3 percentage points in 1 year, and that's a pretty significant drop.
Oh, and what about the racial composition of that?
Well, it still remains the case that people of color in this country have much higher rates of poverty than white people do. The African-American poverty rate is 24.1%. That did see a decline of 2.1 percentage points, but it still remains true that nearly 1 in 4 African-Americans are in poverty. Hispanic also poverty rate is much higher than that of white. The white poverty rate over the overall there, it's 21.4%. Also saw a significant drop between 2014 and 2015. And then the white non-Hispanic poverty rate, 9.1%, much lower than the other two poverty rates. And that saw a decline of 1 percentage point.
Smaller, though, than the black and Hispanic poverty rate declines.
That's right, a smaller decline, but they also have a lot less distance to cover in terms of eradicating poverty.
This almost seems too cynical to bring up, but this is the kind of thing you see at the late in a business cycle expansion, maybe a year or two before a recession hits. Is this about as good as it gets?
No, I'm optimistic that things are going to continue to get better. If we see this kind of year next year in terms of incomes, we're going to have erased the losses that many people felt in terms of their income growth from the Great Recession. We'll be back on that trajectory. And I think that preliminary wage growth this year, if you can look at the hourly wage growth from the monthly survey, you can see that we would expect some gains to be felt across the distribution, I would think, in the next year. And I think that will keep going. I mean, we have seen a very slow recovery, right? That's what you're signaling, is that we've just been trudging along. But I think if we keep going on this pace, if we keep letting the economy recover, the Fed keeps holding off raising rates, then I think we will see better numbers next year.
There was some suspicion from the usual quarters, you know, mainly people on the far right with a supporting chorus of people on the far left who thought these numbers were either cooked or there are also changes in the way the survey was conducted that might have contributed to this strong rise. How seriously or unseriously should we take these numbers? Are they too good to be true?
No, I have no reason to believe that these are not the accurate numbers coming out of the Census Bureau that comes out every year. There were changes to the survey in 2013 that's been reflected in the 2014 and 2015 data. And in fact, when we talk about the changes back before that adjustment, we make an imputation based on the data going back in time to try to capture the best trends that we can. So no, I have no reason to think that any of these data were cooked. I don't believe that that happens when they come out of the Census Bureau, out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Those data are based on very long-term surveys that are done year after year after year.
There is an awful lot of skepticism about some of this stuff. So could you review how these numbers are collected and put together?
Sure. Every month, the Census Bureau runs a survey that goes to households across the United States, and they ask a series of questions. And in the March survey, they ask questions about the previous year. It's very close to tax season in March, and so hopefully people have a pretty good sense of what their incomes were in the previous year. So in March of 2016, they're asking information about the full year 2015, and so they can get their incomes and their earnings. And that's how they calculate the official poverty rate, using those measures.
I'm speaking with Elise Gould, who is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington. And the poverty rate, people throw around that number. Well, what does it mean exactly?
The official poverty rate, that's 13.5%, is trying to measure how many people fall below an absolute threshold. And arguably, the official poverty rate is a little bit outdated. It doesn't take into account geographic variation. It also doesn't take into account forms of non-cash income that many families would receive. And so in response to that, the Census Bureau is coming out with the supplemental poverty measure, and that tries to take into account other factors that might be affecting incomes over time.
Now, how was the original poverty line calculated?
Oh, in the 1960s, they came out with the poverty line, and it was taken as a food budget times three. And all that's happened since then is they have updated that using just simply inflation. And so that's how it's calculated, and it's calculated for different family sizes to adjust for those returns to scale and how much it costs to live in that sense.
Conceptually, the poverty line, a poverty level income, has the same purchasing power that one did 50 years ago. Without any regard to the changes in average incomes or the changes in consumption patterns or anything like that, right?
Right. I mean, that's one of the weaknesses, is that food may have been a third of a typical family budget back then. Food prices have since become a smaller and smaller share. We think about things like the cost of housing or the cost of medical care. Those things have gone up arguably much faster than the cost of food. And so when you don't take into account that threshold, is actually maybe worsening over time.
Even though this has been a good year, last year was a good year, we have a long-term stagnation in incomes, you talked about earlier, a really stubbornly high poverty rate, even given the concept that it's, you know, got the same purchasing power as it did 50 years ago. What is keeping the average American household, what are the headwinds that are keeping it from making any kind of economic progress?
In general, we think about how middle-income families are doing. Again, most of their income is coming from wages. So we have to look at the labor market and to see how well the labor market is treating typical families, typical workers in this country. And we have seen incredibly stagnant wages across the board. And this isn't just since the Great Recession. Yes, we saw some positive numbers last year, but we have a lot of ground to make up for. And I think that's what many families are feeling today, is that sort of stubborn inability for their wages to rise. Again, that is hand in hand with the growing inequality that we've seen in the last 35 years. And so there are many different factors that lead to that disconnect. And there are policies that have been enacted that have, or maybe not have been enacted, to keep that up. So we have let our labor standards erode, for instance. We have let the value of the minimum wage, particularly at the federal level, erode, and that doesn't keep the floor up in the labor market. We've also made it harder to join a union, and the decline in unionization rates in this country have not only led to declining wages, you know, when you think about the union members who or would be union members, but you actually think about the effects that has in terms of setting standards and pay standards for the sectors where unions are popular. And what you saw, what you saw before the Great Recession hit is that the majority of workers who are not in a union want to be in a union. So when we think about what policymakers, the federal government, or states can do going forward is to figure out how to rectify that situation.
Now, if you listen to Donald Trump, the whole problem is that the Chinese and the Mexicans stole our jobs. And that, you know, left us, well, we used to talk about burger flippers. That seems kind of an obsolete term now, but, you know, we're all, you know, with the disappearance of manufacturing jobs, many of us have been thrown into lower paying service jobs. How important a factor is the disappearance of so many manufacturing jobs over the last couple of decades?
Certainly the disappearance of manufacturing jobs is one of the reasons why we've seen decline in unionization, because those were sectors that had good middle-class wages that allowed people to get into the middle class. I'm not an expert on trade, so I can't speak to the magnitude of those problems.
But what about manufacturing itself? Is that the loss of manufacturing jobs, regardless of the source of that loss, how important an influence on the decline in or the stagnation in family incomes is that?
It's certainly important when we think about manufacturing jobs as being jobs that can keep people and get people into the middle class. Without those jobs, many families are having a hard time, certainly in pockets of the country where manufacturing was much more predominant, and losing those jobs is absolutely important. And when we think about the service sector, we can do lots of things to boost up the service sector, and we should think about ways to increase wages across the board. But it certainly has been problematic for many people, the loss of manufacturing.
Yeah, you know, people act as if low wages in the service sector are almost mandated by God, but those things can be actually fairly plastic, can't they?
Yes, there's no reason why service sector jobs have to be low-paying. There's nothing about that. When we think about certain industries or certain occupations that are service sector, let's say child care workers providing a service in terms of taking care of people's children, there's no reason that should necessarily be low wage. In fact, if that's a value that we have in our society, that seems like that should be a relatively higher paying job.
One of my favorite factoids is that parking lot attendants paid a higher hourly rate than child care workers. So you're optimistic for the future that these income gains could continue you know, through this year and into next?
Yes, absolutely. I think that as the economy does continue to recover, as we see the labor market tighten, that will give workers a little bit more leverage to bid up their wages. As workers become a little bit more scarce as the economy tightens and some of those missing workers who have left the labor market return to it and they start getting in the mix in terms of coming off the sidelines and getting jobs and looking for jobs, as the labor market tightens, we will see that translate into more wage growth. I am optimistic that will happen as long as we don't do anything to slow it down. And honestly, you know, one of the reasons why we have seen such a slow recovery is because after we've had the first stimulus, we've really done very little as a federal government to help boost the recovery moving forward. So we've depended so much on Federal Reserve policy to keep their foot off the brakes to allow it to recover. But we could have done so many other things to try to help it along that we have just resisted doing as a government.
And these are some of the best numbers we've seen since the late 1990s. Late 1990s was a time when the unemployment rate actually got below 4% for a brief period of time. It's now comfortably below 6. Is that really key to getting household incomes up?
Yes, absolutely. We need a tighter labor market. And we have plenty of room to go down. We are not at the lowest unemployment rate we can be. We did see in the late 90s, 2000, we saw, I think, 6 months of below 4% unemployment, and nothing happened. There was nothing that happened that was putting an end to the world. We can allow it to get that low, and when we allow it to get that low, that's going to have a disproportionately positive impact on low-wage workers, on workers of color, that will be very meaningful when we think about household income for those groups of workers.
Yeah, I believe the Congressional Budget Office sees the natural rate of unemployment just about where we are now, around 5.5%. Is that too high a concept of nature?
In my opinion, yes, it is too high. The other number we think about the target is what the Federal Reserve targets for inflation, and they're targeting about 2% inflation. One of the reasons why we saw such large gains in income, again, stemming from the earnings growth, is because inflation was so low. It was 0.1% between 2014 and 2015. Inflation remains below 2% today. We can go much higher in terms of lowering the unemployment rate before we see those inflationary pressures. That's the only reason, really, the Fed would be considering raising rates, but there is no inflationary pressure in sight, and so we have plenty of room to let that recover and before we hit that. So, no, I think that's wrong. I think that the unemployment rate can go much lower than it is today.
You do see some excitable sorts within the Fed worrying about being too generous, too loose, and this is going to cause problems for the future, but it's just another way of saying that household incomes are rising too much.
Right. I don't see this as problematic. I think we still have a lot to go before we gain the losses from the Great Recession, let alone getting us back to the full unemployment economy that we had in 2000. Let's let the economy recover. That's what I say.
That was Elyse Gould, a senior economist for the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Poverty by the Gang of Four. As you can probably tell, they're against it. Wednesday, September 28th, brought news of the death of Israeli politician Shimon Peres. Peres had served in a number of high offices in that country, including prime minister, president, foreign minister, finance minister, defense minister, and I'm probably missing one or two. The encomia have flowed. The New York Times called him a philosopher politician, a tireless worker in public service to his country, a dreamer, and one who first built up defense, but then devoted his life to the search for peace. Most of their emphasis is on the latter, the peacemaking, notably the Oslo Accords of 1993. There is less to those than we are usually told, as we'll hear imminently. And the war part was quite major. Peres fought with the Haganah, a Zionist guerrilla group that did lots of ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the late 1940s, was heavily responsible for Israel's nuclear program, ordered a brutal Israeli operation against Lebanese civilians in 1996, viewed Israel's Arab citizens as a demographic threat, and consistently defended the brutalization of the occupied territories. His ill will extended beyond Palestinians, commenting on reports that millions of Iranians were unable to get cancer treatment because of sanctions. He said that if they want to return to a normal life, let them become normal. For more on the career of Shimon Peres, here is Joel Bainan, a professor of Middle Eastern history at Stanford University. Bainan grew up in a Zionist household and intended to move to Israel permanently as a youth. But he was put off by Israeli attitudes towards the Palestinians they displaced and came back to the U.S. He's written or edited 9 books and writes frequently in the popular press as well. He spent a number of years living in both Israel and Egypt. Joel Bainum.
The death of Shimon Peres has brought out all the praise for him as a man of peace. Is that your evaluation of his career?
It's unseemly to speak ill of the recently departed, so I'll moderate what I might say to a certain extent by that norm. But no, he wasn't a man of peace. His entire career is more closely aligned with war making.
Well, let's trace the arc of that career. I mean, he goes way back in the history of the state of Israel, correct?
That's right. He was in 1948 during the war that ultimately established the State of Israel, assigned by Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, the first Prime Minister of Israel, to go to Europe to purchase weapons. After the state was established, he was the key person in the civilian apparatus of the Ministry of Defense to make contact with France. France was Israel's main arms supplier during the 1950s and up to the 1967 war. Most notably, France supplied Israel with tanks and with the nuclear technology and equipment that ultimately enabled Israel to build a nuclear weapon.
I don't think most people know about that. How did France occupy that role, which, of course, the United States subsequently took over, but how did the French start out as Israel's main patron?
There was, after 1948, an agreement among United States, Britain, and France to impose an arms embargo on the Middle East, including Israel. The United States more or less observed it, and likewise Britain. That meant, for example, that the Egyptian army was not resupplied after its disastrous defeat in the 1948 war. But France had a particular problem, which is that soon after Israel was established, it was facing anti-colonial insurgencies in Vietnam, in Algeria, and less well-armed but still important nationalist movements in Morocco and Tunisia. France was unwilling to come to the conclusion that its days as an imperial power were over. The United States urged France to give up its empire, as it did the British, for essentially Cold War reasons. If the French allies of the United States were seen to be vicious imperialist occupiers in Algeria, then perhaps the Soviet Union and local communist forces might make headway. That was a very bad misunderstanding of the situation in Algeria by the United States, but that's another story. So France was looking for partners in the region, and Israel was more than willing because France not only had a problem in Algeria, France had a problem with the Egyptian regime because the free officers who came to power in 1952, led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, were enthusiastic supporters of the Algerian revolution. Nasser was seen as an enemy of Israel, so the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and Israel and France collaborated against the Algerian independence movement on many different levels, including Yitzhak Shamir, the former prime minister of Israel, when he was head of the Mossad in Europe, sending letter bombs to Algerian independence figures in Europe.
And the U.S. just sat back and watched France get active in the region?
No, the United States really tried to pressure France to come to a reasonable conclusion of its Algerian adventure. Algeria did that as early as 1958. Charles de Gaulle, after he came to power, made it pretty clear that this was going to end. And it did in 1962. So the United States would have preferred that it ended sooner and in a less bloody way, to be sure. And France did negotiate peaceful withdrawal from Morocco and Tunisia, but Algeria was always much more freighted politically and emotionally for France, so it took longer.
I was referring, though, to the French-Israeli relationship. The U.S. was okay with that, or had trouble, or how did Uncle Sam look on it?
The Eisenhower administration had a lot of trouble with Israel. In 1953, soon after Eisenhower came into office, he ordered a complete reappraisal of U.S.-Israeli relations, which didn't do much but shake things up for a while. At that point, the United States was not an arms supplier. There was minimal U.S. economic aid going to Israel. Most of the capital flowing from the United States to Israel was private contributions of American Jews. To raise the question to a very high level would have risked the ire of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, whose predecessor was just then emerging on the political scene. But the real showdown between Israel and France and Britain and the United States over this question came in 1956, when Israel collaborated with Britain and France in attacking Egypt after Egypt nationalized the Suez Canal. Israel, in the course of that war, occupied the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula, and Prime Minister Ben-Gurion proclaimed that the Third Kingdom of Israel had been established, and President Eisenhower very quickly said, "Oh, no, you don't. You are getting out of there right away." And Eisenhower was roundly criticized and excoriated on this by no less than Lyndon Johnson, who was then president of the Senate pro tem, and Eisenhower responded in a way that we cannot imagine any American president responding today. On foreign policy, the United States speaks with one voice, and that voice is the voice of the president of the United States. So basically, I don't care if there's a Democratic majority in the Senate and you don't like what I did. I'm the president. I'm the commander-in-chief. This is how it's going to go. So Israel did withdraw, of course, then, but that even strengthened the alliance with France, which was already underway. The British were suitably chastised and learned a lesson, perhaps.
Okay, well, that was a bit of a detour away from the career of Shimon Peres, so let's get back to him. What, although an interesting one, I certainly didn't know that much about the French connection, but what was he doing in the early years of the State of Israel? Was he involved in transferring Palestinian people away from their homeland?
No, he never had any operational military responsibility, which is one of the reasons why, in political terms, he was never particularly popular in Israel. He worked as a bureaucrat all the way up to director general of the Ministry of Defense, so he knew lots about military policy and so on, but he was never in the line of military command.
But he did, throughout the course of his career, occupy most of the major positions in the state, right?
Yes, that's true. So the most important moment came after the 1967 war, when all of the forces of the labor Zionist movement gradually united in what is today the Labor Party. And at a certain point, Peres became a cabinet minister. And he was the patron of several of the early West Bank settlements.
In what sense was he the patron?
His political view, almost until the very end, even after the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993, was that Jordan should have political responsibility over the Gaza Strip and over the West Bank, excuse me, and Israel should control it militarily, and there would be a certain amount of Israeli settlement in the West Bank, and that wouldn't get in the way of an arrangement with Jordan. So there were several competing notions about how much to settle and where to settle in the West Bank amongst the different leading Labor Party figures, and Peres was one of the contenders in that argument.
What specifically did he do to hasten the settlements?
So as a cabinet minister, he had a budget, and he could just give people cash to carry out the initial settlement activity. And then, as Minister of Defense at one point, also order the army to protect them.
Was this the late 60s we're talking about?
No, 70s.
Okay, so that's what he was doing in the 70s. Then moving into the next decade, how did he occupy himself in the 80s?
So the most important thing that he did in the 80s was that he rotated as prime minister in a national unity government with Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. He's the one who was sending the letter bombs to the Algerians back in the 50s. And in the early 1980s, Israel faced a catastrophic economic crisis. At one point, the annual rate of inflation was over 1,000%. And they basically called in your standard IMF types and imposed the Washington Consensus austerity package. That was 1985. Paris was to a considerable extent personally responsible for that. And that did turn Israel's economy around in a certain sense. It, of course, did what all the Washington Consensus economic packages do. It increased the gap between the rich and the poor, privatized a huge amount of public assets. Before 1985, some people imagined that Israel was a socialist country because it had a very large public sector. That's much less the case now. He semi-privatized healthcare and other social services such as education began to deteriorate at that point as well.
So to just underscore the point, this was when he was with the Labor Party. This was a center-left party doing these classic Washington Consensus things.
This was Blairism. It's not at all unheard of for social democratic parties to do this.
God, no, but sometimes you have to emphasize the point. I'm speaking with Joel Bainin, who is a professor of Middle Eastern history at Stanford. He was, of course, most famous for the Oslo Accords. So how did we get there?
In December of 1987, Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip rose up in an unarmed rebellion against the occupation, which had at that point been in place for over 20 years. And Peres continued at that point to imagine that the solution to the Palestinian issue was to reach some kind of agreement with Jordan. Meanwhile, the PLO was dramatically weakened, both by not having been directly involved in either instigating or leading the uprising, that is the PLO based in Tunis. The local leaders were all members of parties connected to the PLO. And even more disastrously, the PLO appeared to support it, didn't actually support it, but Yasser Arafat went to Baghdad and hugged Saddam Hussein, so appeared to support Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in 1990. So all of the Gulf countries which had been taxing their Palestinian residents and sending the money to the PLO stopped doing that, expelled the Palestinians. 400,000 or so Palestinians were expelled from Kuwait and some hundreds of thousands from Saudi Arabia. So Yasser Arafat and the top leadership of the PLO were looking for a way to get back in the game, and the way to get back in the game was to conduct secret negotiations without the intermediary of the United States, we should underline, because the United States has never actually succeeded in brokering any real peace between Israel and the Palestinians, any real agreement. So they came up with the Oslo Accords. Now, everybody thinks that the Oslo Accords were an agreement to establish a Palestinian state, but that's not at all the case. What the Oslo Accords do is the PLO recognizes the State of Israel. The State of Israel recognizes the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people and agrees to negotiate with them. And there is no specific mention of a Palestinian state in the Oslo Accords, and one of the reasons for that is that in 1993, when the Accords were signed, both Shimon Peres, who was at that point, I believe, Minister of Finance, I'm not positive about that, and Yitzhak Rabin, who was Prime Minister, opposed a Palestinian state. So they signed the Accords. Maybe Peres was foreign minister at that time. I think that's right. I think he was foreign minister. So Peres and Rabin and Arafat get the Nobel Prize for an agreement which, as we can see in retrospect, did not bring peace at all. And everybody thinks he's wonderful.
I guess, well, the Oslo Accords are in some memories a great step forward for peace, but therefore the sanctification of Peres's memory resulted from that, but this is just not true.
No, and it's particularly important to underline that both Peres and Rabin, although Rabin appears to have changed his mind a few months before he was assassinated in 1995, opposed the establishment of a Palestinian state. And the Labor Party's program opposed the establishment of a Palestinian state until that program was changed months before the 1996 election, in which Rabin, at that point, having been assassinated, Peres led the Labor Party to defeat.
And so after the Oslo Accords, how did he occupy his time?
So he was, I think we agreed, defense minister after Oslo, then acting prime minister and acting defense minister after Rabin was assassinated in November of 1995. And then there was a general election in the spring of 1996, and he led the Labor Party to defeat.
He never really achieved electoral success, right, despite his grand reputation?
No. Despite having occupied many important positions, he never led his party to an electoral victory. No party has ever won an outright victory. It's always a coalition in Israel, but whatever party he led never became the leader of the coalition.
So to what do we owe this grand reputation and all the hosannas in his on his death?
I think a few things. First, liberal Zionists, the American political and media establishment, still would like us to think that the Oslo Accords was a historic step which laid the basis for a two-state solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which seems to me all but impossible at this point. But if that's the case, if the whole Oslo process was a failure, not only Peres, Rabin, and Arafat failed, but also Clinton and the United States failed, and every American president who's continued to uphold the Oslo process as the way forward has failed, and then what do we do? then we have to actually start thinking seriously, which American political pundits don't really like to do. So we continue with this somewhat empty narrative about the importance of Oslo. Second, Paris did establish the Paris Center for Peace in 1996 after he lost that election. It doesn't do very much of real importance, but it has a wonderful name and has lots of money behind it, so that helps to burnish your name and reputation. And that seems to be what's required, smoke and mirrors.
You sounded quite skeptical about the prospects for a two-state solution. Could you talk more about that?
Well, there are now something close to 650,000 Jewish settlers in occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank. There are Knesset members who live in those settlements. There is no viable movement inside Israel for any form of negotiation on a serious basis with the Palestinians. Neither, of course, the current government, which is the most right-wing government Israel has ever had. We keep on saying that the last few elections, and each one is further right yet. But also the Labor Party has more or less announced that it's not interested in that because it doesn't want to appear to be pro-Arab, as the leader said. So there are only minuscule Jewish forces in Israel who support any reasonable form of a two-state solution. The Arab population of Israel, about 20% of Israeli citizens are Palestinian Arabs, generally speaking, do support two states, but they can't be involved in arranging such a thing because the Jewish population would see it as illegitimate. The United States, which is the most important external factor, is not exerting the slightest bit of pressure on Israel to move in the direction of two states. Other international actors like the European Union and perhaps the UN Security Council have begun to make noises, but this is far too little and far too late, and the current Israeli government simply does not give a hoot about international opinion as long as the United States continues to supply the military aid, which has just been renewed at the highest level ever. So from the point of view of the Israeli right wing, Israel is in the catbird seat. Benjamin Netanyahu outsmarted Barack Obama, who came into office with a commitment to try to resolve this conflict, and he leaves office with things worse than they have ever been before.
And basically there is no constituency either in the Israeli political class or in the broad population for anything other than permanent war, is there?
They don't call it permanent war. They call it managing the conflict. And one of the really ugly phrases that is used for Israel's periodic assaults on the Gaza Strip is mowing the lawn. And since it's usual that large numbers of Israeli soldiers aren't killed in such operations, sometimes things go wrong, to be sure, that's acceptable.
So is there any way out of this that you can imagine?
There, of course, is a way out of this. I'm a historian, and the one thing you learn from history is that things change. Does that mean that I know what the way out of this is? No, I do not. The regional balance of forces is going to change. The autocratic counter-revolution is not stable. The post-Arab uprising autocratic counter-revolution is not stable. The renewed effort to get countries like Egypt and Tunisia to adopt Washington consensus neoliberal policies, even if they nominally agree to do so, is catastrophic. I mean, those are the things that led to the social unrest that underlay the 2011 uprisings. the power of the United States globally is in decline. China is not particularly interested in underwriting all of Israel's occupation and violations of human rights and so on. Not that China cares too much about human rights, but they would have a different view of that sort of thing. So things will change. I don't think they are going to change very soon. There's going to be a lot more pain and suffering and ugliness, but things will change.
Thanks. That's pretty glum. Okay, thank you very much for
doing
this.
No, I'm an optimist. I really do believe things will change.
Ah, well, the question is when?
I don't know.
Yeah, right. You're a historian, not a seer.
Right.
I was Joel Bainan, professor of Middle Eastern History at Stanford University. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, an acoustic version of What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding by Nick Lowe. What's so funny indeed. Till next week, bye.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, oh yeah, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain? And misery. And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I want to know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, understanding?